Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and we need to, do I need to literally remind you the importance of our appeal to heaven, that we need to be smarter, we need to be able to articulate more what our problems are, so that as we do so, we can actually see the solutions, because you don't know what you don't know, and if it's not a problem, then you don't know it, because you don't know. So the whole, this whole message, what we're doing, Republic Review, and this effort in taking back our government, it's all about constitutional compliance. Our public servants do not have authority to go beyond those powers, roles, responsibilities, property, etc., that is delegated in that Constitution, period. If it ain't there, they can't do it. They can't compromise to themselves. You know, well, the two parties agree, we're gonna create health care. We're going to create the Department of Education. Well, hold on. No, you can't. You need us to amend the Constitution. You parties don't have the authority to, you know, basically, out of thin air, create a power. It's that simple, folks. It really is. So we've got Tammy back, and welcome back, Tammy. And we are covering the North Carolina debates. We were just kind of covering religion, and I believe we're in the throes of, with Mr. Abbott, it's down on, let me see here, this is page 134, and it is, again, Mr. Abbott, after expressing his obligation, blah, blah, blah. And then Mr. Iredell will go into a more clarification on helping Mr. Abbott understand these very important matters. So let's go ahead and dive in. Go ahead.
Mr. Abbott, after expressing his obligations for the explanation which had been given, observed that no answer had been given to the question he put concerning the form of an oath. And then Mr. Iredell, Mr. Chairman, I beg pardon for having omitted to take notice of that part which the worthy gentleman has mentioned. It was by no means from design, but from its having escaped my memory, as I have not the conveniency of taking notes. I shall now satisfy him in that particular, in the best manner in my power.
Go ahead, keep going. I mean, you haven't really covered anything worth covering. Go ahead.
Okay. According to the modern definition of an oath, it is considered a solemn appeal to the Supreme Being for the truth of what is said by a person who believes the existence of Supreme Being and in a future state of rewards and punishments according to that form which will bind his conscience most. It was long held that no oath could be administered but upon the New Testament, except to a Jew who was allowed to swear upon the Old. According to this notion, none but the Jews and Christians could take an oath, and heathens were altogether excluded. At length, by the operation of principles of toleration, these narrow emotions were done away. Men at length considered that there were many virtuous men in the world who had not had an opportunity of being instructed either in the Old or New Testament, who yet very sincerely believed in a Supreme Being and in a future state of rewards and punishments. It is well known that many nations entertain this belief who do not believe either in the Jewish or Christian religion. Indeed, there are few people so grossly ignorant or barbarous as to have no religion at all, and if none but Christians or Jews could be examined upon oath, many innocent persons might suffer for want of the testimony of others. In regard to the form of an oath, that ought to be governed by the religion of the person taking it. Hold on, my page just jumped.
Yeah, I remember to have read an instance, which happened in England, I believe, in the time of Charles II. Just kind of carrying you forward. You there? Or did it really jump?
Keep going.
Okay. A man who was a material witness in a cause refused to swear upon the book, and he was admitted to swear with his uplifted hand. The, let me see here, because I've got to carry it over. The jury had a difficulty in crediting him, but the Chief Justice told him he had, in his opinion, taken as strong an oath as any other witness, though he had not been to swear himself, he should have kissed the book. Anyway, one of the things that people didn't know, because we were never taught this in school, that if you wanted to have a case in court, when you go to court, if you're not a Christian in good standing, you could not bear testimony in court in America. After the Constitution was ratified, it was very common. As a matter of fact, Alexis de Tocqueville in the 1830s, I think it was 1833, when he noted that a court in New York threw out a case because the plaintiff was an atheist. And he was basically, you know, making a case that somebody had done him wrong. And the judge basically says, you have no credit with this court. If you can't be held to a higher authority, then we can't believe you. And, you know, you have no credit. You're a heathen. And Joseph's story kind of expounded on that, that only the Christians and the Jews in America at that point in time were the only ones that were given credit in a case, or I should say, in a court of law. That all changed, you know, quickly as the Bar Association started getting entrenched, moving more into its ranks and its formation in the 1870s. So, anyway, are you there now?
No.
Okay, so you see Charles.
Okay.
So start at the top. And then just kind of page down, because it was you kind of left off with Charles II, or that's where I left off with the Andrew lifted. She was kind of in the middle of the whole thing. So Charles credited him, admitted the swear of the lifted hand. Anyway, I'll just continue reading, folks.
Continue reading. I'll find it.
Okay. The jury had a difficulty in crediting him, but the Chief Justice told them that they had, in his opinion, taken as strong as an oath as any other witness, though he had been to swear himself he should have kissed the book. A very remarkable instance also happened in England about 40 years ago of a person who was admitted to take an oath according to the rites of his own country, though he was a heathen. He was an East Indian who had a great suit of chancery, and his answer upon the oath to a bill filed against him was absolutely necessary. Not believing either in the Old or New Testament, he could not be sworn in as in an accustomed manner, but was sworn according to the form of Gento religion, which he professed by touching the foot of a priest. It appeared that according to the tenets of this religion, its members believed in a supreme being and in a future state of rewards and punishments, and possibly even reincarnation. Anyway, it was accordingly held by the judges upon the consideration that the oath ought to be received, they considering that it was probable those that of that religion were equally bound in conscience by an oath according to their form of swearing, as they themselves were by one of theirs, and that it would be a reproach to the justice of the country if a man, merely because he was a different religion from their own, should be denied redress in an injury he had sustained. Ever since this great cause, it has been universally considered that in administering an oath, it is only necessary to inquire if the person who is to take it believes in a supreme being and in a future state of rewards and punishments. Now I'm on the bold red right here. If he does, the oath is administered according to that form which it was supposed will bind his conscience most. It is, however, necessary that such a belief should be entertained, because otherwise there would be nothing to bind his conscience and that could be relied on, since there are many cases where the terror of punishment in this world or perjury could not be dreaded. I have endeavored to satisfy the committee. We may, I think, very safely leave religion to itself as to the form of the oath. I think this may well be trusted to the general government to be applied on the principles I have mentioned. You got to remember, it's got to be left to the states, too. Each state's got to determine their own. Anyway, so now Governor Johnston steps in. Are you with me here?
Yep.
Okay, so now he kind of takes up from where Mr. Iredell left off.
Governor Johnston expressed great astonishment that the people were alarmed on the subject of religion. This, he said, must have arisen from the great pains which had been taken to prejudice men's minds against the Constitution. He begged leave to add the following few observations to what had been so ably said by the gentleman last up. I read the Constitution over and over, but could not see one cause of apprehension or jealousy on this subject. When I heard there were apprehensions that the Pope of Rome could be the President of the United States, I was greatly astonished. It might as well be said that the King of England or France or the Grand Turk could be chosen to that office. It would have been as good an argument. It appears to me that it would have been dangerous if Congress could intermeddle with the subject of religion. True religion is derived from a much higher source than human laws. When any attempt is made by any government to restrain men's consciences, no good consequence can possibly follow. It is apprehended that Jews, Mohammedans, pagans, etc. may be affected to high offices under the government of the United States. Those who are Mohammedans or any others who are not professors of the Christian religion can never be elected to the office of president or other high office but in one or two cases. First, if the people of America lay aside the Christian religion altogether, it may happen. Should this unfortunately take place, the people will choose such men as they do themselves. Another case is, if any persons of such description, notwithstanding their religion, acquire the confidence and esteem of the people of America by their good conduct and practice of virtue, they may be chosen. I leave it to gentlemen's candor to judge what probability there is of the people's choosing men of different sentiments from themselves.
Okay,
great apprehension has been raised.
So let me just cut in here. It's unlike me to do that, by the way. Just being a little sarcastic. So he's making some interesting points that, you know, he's actually saying that there may be other people of another religion that may actually gain prominence in America, that they may actually become the president, like a Mohammedan. He actually says that, right? And I'm going, I don't believe these guys understood these faiths. It wasn't just, you know, religions are all equal. There is a difference. I'll just say, statism, subjugation, it's the same, right? It's liberty or subjugation. That's the scale of liberty goes, you know, in one direction, right? You've got full liberty, and you gradually give up more and more power from basically pure white to black, where you're fully subjugated. And every step of the way, you're subjugated a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here, there. And so we lose our full liberty. In a world today, we cannot have full liberty of being able to just get in our car and drive anywhere we want with government basically making a road for us as we go. If the concept of what we would call the, you know, states, nationals, sovereign citizens, or these people that believe that they don't have to, you know, have a driver's license or, you know, submit to any laws, then fine, if you want to drive a car, you drive a car on your own road. You build it yourself, and you got to buy the property to go from there to there to do that. Because when you leave your property, you're on somebody else's property. And somebody has to basically give you permission, or you have to buy that property. So you're going to have to take care of all that yourself. But we, as a civil society, even though our government never had this, and the bottom line, our government needs to have this, we need to delegate probably to the state government, very limited with the controls of the counties, very limited infrastructure responsibilities to ensure we have standards to make sure that, you know, the needs of the counties are being met. which means that in a civil society, we can actually create the rules of the road. You know the old saying, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. And so it just kills me that we have people living in Rome that claim to be Romans, but they don't want to, you know, live as the Romans do. Anyway, go ahead. Let's go down to the next one. But great apprehension.
But great apprehensions have been raised as to the influence of the eastern states. When you attend circumstances, this will have no weight. I know but two or three states where there is the least chance of establishing any particular religion. The people of Massachusetts and Connecticut are mostly Presbyterian. In every other state, the people are divided into a great number of sects. In Rhode Island, the tenets of the Baptists, I believe, prevail. In New York, they are divided very much. The most numerous are the Episcopalians and the Baptists. In New Jersey, they are as much divided as we are. In Pennsylvania, if any sect prevails more than others, it is that of the Quakers. In Maryland, the Episcopalians are most numerous, though there are other sects. In Virginia, there are many sects. You all know what their religion sentiments are. So in all the southern states, they differ, as also in New Hampshire. I hope, therefore, that gentlemen will see there is no cause of fear that any one religion shall be exclusively established.
Okay, so Mr. Codwell then kind of jumps down, because I actually, you know, kind of calculated that the way I saw it, that the majority of the people overall throughout this throughout the states was Episcopal or Anglican, and that the majority of the people coming to America at that time were Anglican as well, because they were coming from England, majority of them. And so there were some French coming in. But point is that had the Constitution not been formed and had the Articles of Confederation been maintained, I believe it would have ultimately been decided by a democracy, 50% plus one, that the United States or the Confederation would have became Anglican. And then the folly would begin with the persecution, the holy wars, everything, all over again. So, Mr. Codwell, go ahead.
Mr. Caldwell thought that some danger might arise. He imagined it might be objected to in a political as well as in a religious view. In the first place, he said, there was an invitation for Jews and pagans of every kind to come among us. At some future period, said he, this might endanger the character of the United States. Moreover, even those who do not regard religion acknowledge that the Christian religion is best calculated of all religions to make good members of society on account of its morality. I think then, added he, that in a political view, those gentlemen who formed this constitution should not have given this invitation to Jews and heathens. All those who have any religion are against the immigration of those people from the Eastern Hemisphere.
Okay, interesting. So Mr. Spencer then said this.
Mr. Spencer was an advocate for securing every unalienable right and that of worshiping God according to the dictates of conscience in particular. He therefore thought that no one particular religion should be established. Religious tests, said he, have been the foundation of persecutions in all countries. Persons who are conscientious will not take the oath required by religious tests and will therefore be excluded from offices, though equally capable of discharging them as any member of the society. It is feared, continued he, that persons of bad principles, theists, atheists, etc., may come to this country and there is nothing to restrain them from being eligible to offices. He asked if it was reasonable to suppose that the people would choose men without regarding their characters. Mr. Spencer then continued thus, gentlemen urge that the want of a test admits the most vicious characters to offices. I desire to know what test could bind them. If they were of such principles, it would not keep them from enjoying those offices. On the other hand, it would exclude from offices conscientious and truly religious people, though equally capable as others. Conscientious persons would not take such an oath and would be therefore excluded. This would be a great cause of objection to a religious test. But in this case, as there is not a religious test required, it leaves religion on the solid foundation of its own inherent validity without any connection with temporal authority, and no kind of oppression can take place. I confess, it strikes me so. I am sorry to differ from the worthy gentleman. I cannot object to this part of the Constitution. I wish every other part was as good and proper.
Interesting. Interesting. So here's an interesting observation, because as we were going through the ratification debates, you heard me say how much focus in Massachusetts there was on religion and the spirituality and, you know, the spiritual essence of the Constitution. And we're kind of getting that in North Carolina too, aren't we? More so than Virginia, definitely more so than New York. And so it's interesting how each of the states, what was really, you know, on their mind, or, you know, pressing them and saying, I got a problem with this because of this. I just find it that there was this commonality of this religion. And I go through this every year, and I always make the mistake that South Carolina, I think, there was the one that, you know, speaks of the Mohammedan, but actually it's North Carolina. And so I don't know if we covered South Carolina. If we did, we just went through it quickly. But anyway, you can tell that these people were very, very wired both on law and religion, because that they get into the details of the law itself. So Mr. Governor Johnson now goes into this.
Governor Johnson approved of the worthy member's candor. He admitted a possibility of Jews, pagans, etc. immigrating to the United States. Yet he said they could not be in proportion to the immigration of Christians who should come from other countries. That in all probability the children even of such people would be Christians, and that this, with the rapid population of the United States, their zeal for religion and love of liberty, would trusted add to the progress of Christian religion among us.
That's a good positive spin, I think, right? Okay, now the seventh article was read without any objection to it. Now the seventh article is what? The ratification process, right? So now Governor Johnston basically gives a short speech, and keep on going.
Governor Johnson, that this committee, having fully deliberated on the Constitution proposed for the future government of the United States of America by the Federal Convention lately held at Philadelphia on the 17th day of September last, and having taken into their serious consideration the present critical situation of America, which induces them to be of opinion that though certain amendments to the said Constitution may be wished for, yet that those amendments should be proposed subsequent to the ratification on the part of this state and not previous to it. They therefore recommend that the convention do ratify the Constitution and at the same time propose amendments to take place in one of the modes prescribed by the Constitution.
Okay, so I'm not sure that actually happened where they actually ratified it. I don't believe they did. I think it was just saying it's proposed that we do this. Now, there's still some resistance, right? So Mr. Lenore, who's an anti-federalist, comes up and makes some, you know, comments regarding the commission again. Now, they're at the end of the debates. And now he's bringing up, hey, these guys exceeded their commission. We shouldn't even be talking about ratifying this. In other words, they just keep on bringing up the same issue that they've already resolved to move forward on. Right. Instead of accepting the fact that the majority of the people didn't believe they exceeded their commission, and then he wants to bring it up again to say, oh, they did. Well, okay, vote the way you want. We're moving forward without you. So at this point, we're going into a break. And so when we come back, we'll pick up this anti-federalist comment, and actually he has a few different comments regarding the commission, exclusive legislation, and slavery. And then we'll get into Mr. Spate's responses in kind and so forth. So we'll be right back after this short promo. Thank you, folks.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so actually, that comment line is dying. I'm kind of allowing that to languish. We actually have a 202 number, so I'm going to be changing that part of the, you know, the back brief. Anyway, now we have some anti-federalist sentiments, and it's kind of like that part in the scriptures where you're dealing with somebody that is just refusing to acknowledge the truth. You know, it's like, surely it's bright out, but that's the moon, not the sun. It's just extra bright tonight, you know, while we're standing out midday, right? And they're just claiming that it's actually the middle of the night. That's not the sun, that's the moon. They're in that stark denial. And we see this in, you know, in people today regarding good and evil. Well, this is what the anti-federalists got so consumed with, you know, trying to do everything they could to protect these power bases that they had in these states. So go ahead with the commission comment.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I conceive that I should not be out of order to make some observations on the last part of the system and take some retrospective view of some other parts of it. I think it not proper for our adoption, as I consider that it endangers our liberties. When we consider this system collectively, we must be surprised to think that any set of men who were delegated to amend the Confederation should propose to annihilate it. For that and this system are utterly different and cannot exist together. It has been said that the fullest confidence should be put in those characters who formed this Constitution. We will admit them in private and public transactions to be good characters. But, sir, it appears to me and every other member of this committee that they exceeded their powers. Those gentlemen had no sort of power to form a new Constitution altogether. Neither had the citizens of this country such an idea in their view. I cannot undertake to say what principles actuated them. I must conceive they were mistaken in their politics, and that this system does not secure the unalienable rights of free men. It has some aristocratical and some monarchical features. Perhaps some of them intended the establishment of one of those governments. Whatever might be their intent, according to my views, it will lead to the most dangerous aristocracy that ever was thought of, an aristocracy established on a constitutional bottom. I conceive, and I believe most of this committee will likewise, that this is so dangerous that I should like as well to have no constitution at all. Their powers are almost unlimited.
So let me throw this out here, because this happens to be North Carolina. So this is what the commission, the state commissioned these men to do. This is what they were granted to go do in the convention. As whereas the limited power, this is from this enabling and delegating them these powers. And whereas the limited powers, which by the Articles of Confederation are vested in the Congress of the United States, have been found far inadequate to enlarged purposes which they are intended to produce, and whereas Congress hath by repeated and most urgent representations endeavored to awaken this and the other states of the Union to a sense of truly critical and alarming situation into which they must be unavoidably cast unless measures are forthwith taken to enlarge the powers of Congress, that there may thereby be enabled to avert the dangers which threaten our existence as a free and independent people. And whereas this state hath been ever desirous to act upon the enlarged system of the general good of the United States without bounding to it to the narrow and selfish object of partial convenience, and has been at all times ready to make concessions to the safety and happiness of the whole with justice and sound policy could vindicate. And then they go on and say that the five commissioners be appointed by a joint ballot of both House and of Assembly, who are of three of them, and hereby authorizes deputies from this state to meet at Philadelphia the first day of May next, then and there to meet and confer with such deputies as to be appointed by the other states for similar purposes, and with them to discuss and decide upon the most effectual means to remove the defects of our federal union and to procure the enlarged purposes which it was intended to effect. In other words, make the changes necessary. And I go, you know, what are these guys... How do these guys make these claims and, you know, and feel like they're honoring this oath of their testimony not to bear false witness? I mean, these guys are under oath for what they're asserting here. And the anti-federalists took a lot of latitude in making these kinds of assertions, that they didn't have the authority. They exceeded their authority. They were just supposed to provide a memo. No. They were given the latitude to enlarge the system as necessary, what they felt necessary. So, therefore, they did. And interestingly enough, there's always somebody, the haters are going to hate, right? So, let's go on to the yellow part where he says, it appears to me instead of securing the sovereignty of the states. He keeps on, you know, dramatizing. I hate to, I know some good Karens out there. I really do. But, you know, this guy kind of, he epitomizes that. So maybe instead of Karens, maybe it should be Lenores, right? Let's yeah, give Karens back their name, and we'll now call the dramatizers the Lenores. Go ahead.
There you go. It appears to me that instead of securing the sovereignty of the states, it is calculated to melt them down into one solid empire. If the citizens of this state like a consolidated government, I hope they will have virtue enough to secure their rights. I am sorry to make use of the expression, but it appears to be a scheme to reduce this government to an aristocracy. It guarantees a republican form of government to the states. When all these powers are in Congress, it will only be a form. It will be past recovery when Congress has the power of the purse and the sword. The power of the sword is in explicit terms given to it. The power of direct taxation gives the purse. They may prohibit the trial by jury, which is a most sacred and valuable right. There is nothing contained in this Constitution to bar them from it. The federal courts have also appellate cognizance of law and fact, the sole cause of which is to deprive the people of that trial, which it is optional in them to grant or not. We find no provisions against infringement on the rights of the conscience. Ecclesiastical courts may be established which will be destructive to our citizens. They may make an establishment they think proper. They have also an exclusive legislation in their 10-mile square, to which may be added their power over the militia, who may be carried thither and kept there for life. Should any one grumble at their acts, he would be deemed a traitor, and perhaps taken up and carried to the exclusive legislation, and there tried without a jury. We are told there is no cause to fear. When we consider the great powers of Congress, there is great cause of alarm. They can disarm the militia. If they were armed, they would be a resource against great oppressions. The laws of a great empire are difficult to be executed. If the laws of the Union were oppressive, they could not carry them into effect if the people were possessed of proper means of defense.
Now, I myself would probably be in trouble and be called out to duel in many of these situations because, you know, I'd be calling these guys out. I mean, how can you say that? The federal government, based on Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 14, and Subsection 15, they're obligated to arm, equip, and train. That's an obligation right there, to call that they have to preserve it so that they can call it forth. They can't undo or basically suppress. You know, the whole concept was argued in detail in Virginia. And I don't think they talked much about the militia in North Carolina. But the reality is this. They cannot create an army until they federalize the militia. That is their army. And the only purpose of forming the army, for them to operate the army, is to execute the laws of the Union, to suppress insurrections, and to repel invasions. Tell that to your son. So, anyway. All right, yeah. So as we, you know, move a little bit further, we actually get to this point where he talks about slaves. And so this is usually where they just go down this path of just really playing, you know, how callous these people are. So go ahead and let's pick up this part about slavery right here. Thank you so much.
Okay. Much has been said of taxation and the inequality of it on the states, but nothing has been said of the mode of furnishing men. In what proportion are the states to furnish men? Is it in proportion to the whites and blacks? I presume it is. This state has 100,000 blacks. By this constitution, 50 Negroes are equal to 30 whites. This state, therefore, besides the proportion she must raise for her white people, must furnish an additional number for her blacks, in proportion as 30 is to 50. Suppose there be a state to the northward that has 60,000 persons. This state must furnish as many men for blacks as that whole state, exclusive of those she must furnish for her whites. Slaves, instead of strengthening, weaken the state. The regulation, therefore, will greatly injure it and the other southern states. There is another clause which I do not, perhaps, understand. The power of taxation seems to me not to extend to the lands of the people of the United States, for the rule of taxation is the number of the whites and three-fifths of the blacks. Should it be the case that they have no power of taxing this object? Must not direct taxation be hard upon the greater part of the state? I am not confident that this is so, but it appears to me that they cannot lay taxes on this object. This will oppress the poor people who have large families of whites and no slaves to assist them in cultivating the soil. Although the taxes are to be laid in proportion to three-fifths of the Negroes and all the whites, another disadvantage to this state will arise from it. This state has made a contract with its citizens, the public securities and certificates I allude to. These may be negotiated to men who live in other states. Should that be the case, these gentlemen will have demands against this state on that account. The Constitution points out the mode of recovery. It must be in the federal court only, because controversies between a state and the citizen another state are cognizable only in the federal courts. They cannot be paid but in gold and silver. Actual specie will be recovered in that court. This would be an intolerable grievance without remedy.
Okay, so interestingly enough, this is not the only state that highlights the problem of the federal government having cognizance over issues or cases or disputes, controversies, between a citizen of another state and a state. And he's pointing it out. The reality is this. He's actually pointing out a legitimate problem. And what happens? Well, the states say, we're getting rid of your cognizance. We're amending that out. You don't have control over that anymore. Done. The 11th Amendment was suggested in 1794 and ratified in 1798. Done. Now they have no jurisdiction in any case between a person from another state or a foreigner with a state. Like if you were from Virginia to sue North Carolina, then they have to sue in North Carolina. They can't go to the federal court. Same thing with a foreigner. A foreigner has to sue in North Carolina and go through their court. The Constitution gave the cognizance and control to the federal court. And the 11th Amendment took that away. Boom, done. And actually, the system worked. When they found a deficiency, and all the states mentioned it, they all had a problem. So was anybody surprised that the 11th Amendment actually turned out in 1794? I wasn't. I was there. I'm just kidding. So anyway, let's... too quick, huh? Let's get into Mr. State talking about the commission. And so this is, you know, where he kind of steps up and defends that along with the exclusive legislation. So there's quite a bit here. So I'll let you go ahead and I'll try to not interrupt you. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I am one of those who formed this Constitution. The gentleman says we exceeded our powers. I deny the charge. We were sent with a full power to amend the existing system. This involved every power to make every alteration necessary to ameliorate and render it perfect. It cannot be said that we arrogated powers altogether inconsistent with the object of our delegation. There is a clause which expressly provides for future amendments, and it is still in your power. What the convention has done is a mere proposal. It was found impossible to improve the old system without changing its very form, for by that system the three great branches of government are blended together. All will agree that the concession of a power to a government so constructed is dangerous. The proposing a new system to be established by the assent and ratification of 9 states arose from the necessity of the case. It was thought extremely hard that one state or even 3 or 4 states should be able to prevent necessary alterations. The very refractory conduct of Rhode Island in uniformly opposing every wise and judicious measure taught us how impolitic it would be to put the general welfare in the power of a few members of the Union. It was, therefore, thought by the convention that if so great a majority as 9 states should adopt it, it would be right to establish it. It was recommended by Congress to the state legislatures to refer it to the people of their different states. Our assembly has confirmed that they have done by proposing it. To the consideration of the people. It was there and not here that the objection should have been made. This convention is therefore to consider the Constitution and whether it be proper for the government of the people of America. And it had been proposed by any one individual under these circumstances, it would be right to consider whether it be good or bad. The gentleman has insinuated that this Constitution, instead of securing our liberties, is a scheme to enslave us. He has produced no proof, but rested on his bare assertion, an assertion which I am astonished to hear after the ability with which every objection has been fully and dearly refuted in the courts of our debates. I am, for my part, conscious of having had nothing in view but the liberty and happiness of my country, and I believe every member of that convention was actuated by motives equally sincere and patriotic.
Yay! So, okay, so now he goes into this next step on the aristocracies and so forth, so let's just keep going. Go ahead.
Okay. He says that it will tend to aristocracy. Where is their aristocratical part of it? It is ideal. I always thought that an aristocracy was that government where the few governed the many, or where the rulers were hereditary. This is a very different government from that. I never read of such an aristocracy. The first branch are representatives chosen freely by the people at large. This must be allowed upon all hands to be democratical. The next is the Senate, chosen by the people in a secondary manner through the medium of their delegates in the legislature. This cannot be aristocratical. They are chosen for 6 years, but one-third of them go out every second year and are responsible to the state legislatures.
Hey, Tammy?
The president is elected. Yep.
So what you read there, the first branch of representatives chosen freely by the people at large. So when we look at the Constitution, because you hear me take swipes at the parties, because the parties actually control who comes into power, into office. The Constitution does not allow the party to create parameters. The design was to allow anybody to get their name on the ballot and to run a campaign. And, you know, to run a campaign, you've got to be successful in going out and communicating. Back in those days, they didn't have corporations. They didn't have deep pockets. So it really took a lot of time, individual time and individual investment to actually, you know, okay, so you had to feed your horse. Instead of paying gas, you had to buy hay or food where they take care of horses, corrals, or there's another word for it. It eludes me, but nevertheless, as you ride into these different towns, you have to basically, you know, get your room and board, and you have to put your horse up so that it can be tended to, fed, and watered, and then you get on your horse and ride to the next town, and ride to the next town. So, I mean, it's not like you're paying gas, but you still have a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of, there's money involved in running a campaign. If you're seriously going to put your name on the on a ballot, then, you know, for you to actually be a threat to anybody, you better get out there and campaign. If not, then nobody's going to vote for you. Back in those days, you had to create the name for yourself. And so once you created the credentials like Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, once those names showed up on the ballot, I'm voting for that guy. You know what I see my point? Because they're proven, right? These are thoroughbreds in politics. This is why when we actually look at the names of the people at the ratification debates, these are the thoroughbreds. When we look at who shows up in Congress and who shows up in the Senate, who shows up in the Supreme Court appointments and the rest of the appointments in the offices and so forth, Thomas Jefferson, Hamilton, John, I mean, these are the thoroughbreds that are going up to the federal government. The other less thoroughbreds are staying at the state, you know, basically honing their skills and getting ready to advance as those older, you know, cows get put out to pasture to die or retire, whatever. The point is that the party, the way the party took full control and said you have to run as a Republican or a Democrat, created a barrier to entry. You can't get your name on the ballot unless you're either one of the two parties or you have to pay or you have to get signatures. They don't have to get signatures. How did they get the free pass? The Constitution doesn't say anywhere where we're supposed to, you know, have to get signatures. You have to get enough people to support you. No, it says it is open to the people at large. And that's so he's hitting something here that really helps support this paradigm I've pointed out, that the party, unfortunately, the legislators have basically abdicated this power to the party. This is where we have a party form of government when it comes to access to office. They have full control over that. They shouldn't have control over the president or any office. And we've allowed them to do this, or I should say our legislators and the Congress and so forth. They've basically set us up into a party system. And we shouldn't be accepting this. But anyway, I digress. I will yield. Go ahead and finish reading what you're reading there. Go ahead.
Okay. The president is elected for 4 years. By whom? By those who are elected in such manner as the state legislatures think proper. I hope the gentleman will not pretend to call this an aristocratical feature, the privilege of representation is secured in the most positive and unequivocal terms and cannot be evaded. The gentleman has said, or the gentleman has again brought on the trial by jury. The Federal Convention, sir, had no wish to destroy the trial by jury. It was 3 or 4 days before them. There were a variety of objections to any one mode. It was thought impossible to fall upon any one mode, but what would produce some inconveniences. I cannot now recollect all the reasons given. Most of them have been amply detailed by other gentlemen here. I should suppose that if the representatives of 12 states, with many able lawyers among them, could not form any unexceptionable mode, this can...
Lawyers
among
yeah.
them. Okay. My eyes are getting tired. With many able lawyers among them could not form any unexceptionable mode, this convention could hardly be able to do it. As to the subject of religion, I thought what had been said would fully satisfy that gentleman and every other. No power is given to the general government to interfere with it at all. Any act of Congress on this subject would be usurpation.
Okay, so right there, we got about a minute left. So I think it's probably best that we, because I don't think we got enough time to read this paragraph. So we'll stop there, especially because, we need to get your eyes into the shower and to get into bed so they can, because they're tired. anyway, I just imagine, they've been working and they're probably sweaty and.
Yeah, I'm so sweaty.
Well, when I watch certain movies, my eyes sweat, right? Anyway, I appreciate your contributions. We're going to miss you. As I look at what we have left, where we are right now, there is still the exclusive legislation that we've got to cover. And then I think we go all the way down, and there's abuses of power, more exclusive legislation, enumerations, and then we get into the amendments and another commerce comment, and then more amendments and some, so I'm going to say we probably got about 2-3 more days, maybe at the most, of the North Carolina debate. So by next week, we should be wrapping up, which means that we should actually be able to dive into the Assumption Acts or the cod fishery bounties. I think we'll do the cod fisheries, then we'll do the Assumption Act, because, we want to cover these things just before the Constitution, because once we're diving into the Constitution, because you remember last year we would do that, and then we would go into the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. And in so doing, that helps everybody kind of in the year up in understanding how important it is that we actually hold those people in government accountable at the federal, state, and even at the county level. We have all the power in the Constitution empowers us to basically petition them, call them out, and demand they be removed. And the supreme law of the land means that they must be removed when that happens. So anyway, thank you so much, folks. We'll be back tomorrow, or actually we'll be back Tuesday. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Claiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
Claiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.